The next matter on our oral calendar this morning is State of Minnesota v. Harris. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that for rebuttal. And those timing restrictions are indicated in the light and the clock that is in the lectern, which you may raise or lower to match your height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that we can, the public can keep track of who's attached to which argument in the audio recording of the presentation. Counsel for appellant, you may start whenever you'd like to.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson, and I represent the appellant Markel Harris Franklin. When Mr. Harris Franklin refused to sign or acknowledge the written petition to waive counsel, the district court was required to follow the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure to obtain a valid waiver, and the judge failed to do so. Additionally, the prosecutor committed misconduct by introducing an extraordinary long body cam video that culminated with police officers vouching for DW's claims against Mr. Harris Franklin by implying that Mr. Harris Franklin had a warrant out for his arrest and that he was going to be returning to jail or some type of incarceration for 2 years for committing the new offense. Under both theories, Mr. Harris Franklin is deserving of a new trial. The district court has a duty to obtain a valid waiver, and the rules are super clear on this, and this court's case law and the Supreme Court's case law is very clear on this, that there's two ways to obtain a valid waiver. One is to get a written waiver, which wasn't obtained here, and two is for the district court to follow Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 5.04, subdivision 1 and 4, that lists specific things that a district court is supposed to go over with a client. Here, the district court indicated that that he should go over the waiver of counsel petition that I think was submitted by defense attorneys here, but was not acknowledged by my client, but then decided not to do so. And instead, he went off cuff and started discussing some things about a trial and your right to trial that had nothing to do with the specific list that's listed under the criminal rules. By doing so, we are left in the situation where we don't know if my client understood and validly waived his right to counsel. It was clear at times that he did not want Mr. Egan and Mr. Haydorf to represent him, but he also indicated that he was concerned about his Sixth Amendment right to counsel and was concerned that he was being forced to go pro se by the failure to the failure for the court to consider.
Well, the court seemed to have significant discussion on that issue with your client, specifically informing him on multiple occasions, no, you don't get another public defender. You can go hire your own lawyer. And it seemed that your client recognized that was going to be the consequence. He wasn't happy with it.
Yep.
But it seemed that he was clear about, he understood that was going to be the consequence.
I think he understood that. What we don't know is if he understood the exact consequences of representing himself. And by going through that laundry list, the list that's been in place for years, and for an experienced judge to not go through that laundry list and to skip over the signed petition, that's the problem in this
case. Counsel, aren't we able to look at the context here, though, as well? Some of the other information that's relevant. This was that your client had some significant experience with the criminal justice system, that there were repeated opportunities to have the discussion with the court about the fact that he didn't want the counsel that was assigned, but he didn't. He kept saying, I want my Sixth Amendment right. It almost seems as if he wasn't going to be satisfied regardless, based on some of the interplay there. But he was appointed counsel to advise him, right? Advisory counsel. So can we look to those parts of this and look at the context to evaluate whether the waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
Well, I would agree that Garibaldi does point out that you are supposed to look at those other factors. It seems in most circumstances before this court and the Supreme Court, we look at what is known and what the knowledge is at the time of the waiver. The application or the assigning him advisory counsel seems to take place after that point. I also think that relying on the fact that he had advisory counsel is problematic here Because if we are going to look at the additional circumstances, we have a situation where the client wanted to call alibi witnesses, yet he did not provide notice in time to provide or to call alibi witnesses, and therefore he was not permitted by the district court judge to call those witnesses. So despite having advisory counsel, he did not have the resources in front of him and was not able to be advised properly by that advisory council to provide notice of those witnesses. So I think that is part of the circumstances this court looks at. And so even though he did have advisory counsel, which is different again from Garibaldi, that the advisory council did not help him with something as basic as providing notice to the state about these additional witnesses. I do want to move on with my remaining time to the second issue. I don't think that there's a question here about the error that took place. And I think from reading the Big Bear case that's cited in my reply brief, that it is clear now that a prosecutor intentionally commits misconduct when they don't redact body cam video, which if the court has had the opportunity to watch this body cam video, it is extremely long. It is filled with lots of irrelevant information, including exposing the complainant DW in this case, why that was played for the jury is kind of unknown. She does make a claim that my client and names him during the ride to the hospital, and then I think everything has to be looked at the context of the officer's statements once they get to the hospital. That the one of the officers says, "We know who it is, though, because she's already made the claim." And the way that they're speaking about my client is that they're already for sure that they know what happens. And that's the vouching problem that we have here.
Well,
Addition.
I think that's pretty good. The state, I think, agrees with you on that prong.
Well, I think they disagreed that it qualified as vouching. I think their argument was that vouching can only take place when an officer testifies at trial and the prosecutor elicits testimony vouching for the
They
witnesses.
accepted the plain error, I think, is what I'm referring to.
Yes, I think that is correct. But I think that the vouching actually is even more apparent here and worse here than even if you called an officer on the stand, because you have multiple officers standing around. You are essentially getting a look for the jury into their mindset of a case that is at the early stages of being prosecuted, and they've already reached their decision that it's unquestioned, and they're laughing about how guilty my client is and about how he's done these things before. And additionally, they make references. I know that the judge said that she didn't see any reaction from the jury when the word DOC was used, but the context of officers speaking, saying that he's wanted, saying that he's going to go back to the DOC for 2 years, I don't think there's any way, even for the most basic juror who knows very little
You
about the
know, I mean,
criminal.
the district court did offer an instruction to give one, and your client rejected it. What how does that play in to all
Well,
of
if
this?
I remember correctly, my understanding was that the district court decided not to give the instruction because they were worried about it causing additional attention, and that I don't think my client specifically requested it, but I don't think it was my client's request. I think it was the judge's decision that.
I thought the judge had offered it and your client declined it. Maybe I'm
And I might be
misrecalling.
wrong on the record too. I'm not going to question if your honors
I
have
could
read
be
it
too.
more
I could be wrong
recently.
too,
Yeah,
but
but my memory of it was that it was put forth by the judge that an instruction potentially could draw more attention to it. What is
counsel,
also
assuming
surprising.
we agree with you that this was plain error, that all the problems that you're pointing out here were present, explain to us how the state hasn't carried its burden on the third prong, which is to show that this actually did not affect the substantial rights of your client.
Oh, that's a great question. I would say that I think the state is very much entrenched in the fact that a single witness, DW, was unquestionably said that my client is the person who did this. And they tried to differentiate the fact that her boyfriend, who had pulled a gun on her in the past and had been abusive to her in the past, had a different body type and didn't have facial tattoos by my client. But again, she's the only person that we have. And I understand that the statute allows for a single witness to meet the sufficiency standard, but it's different when we're talking about prejudice. She obviously had had a she makes claims of having this prior bad history with my client over him leaving this note. about a claim for sexual favors, and we also potential, you know, she gets shot by somebody, that's unquestioned, but it doesn't matter
well,
that my
cut with a 9mm, right?
Correct.
And 9mm casings were found at the scene, and also throughout the vehicle that your client was driving.
That is correct, and I think we all have been a part of the court system long enough to know that a 9mm is a pretty common bullet and gun, and it doesn't, you know, we don't have any forensics here. We don't have a BCA analyst who comes in and compares the bullets. And
well, I mean, I agree, but, well, I'll take your word for it. But at the end of the day, a lot of people aren't driving around with 9mm ammunition in their car. Would that be a fair statement?
That's correct, but maybe somebody with a long criminal history might be more likely to have 9mm in their car, but not necessarily the perpetrator of this crime. So,
let's see if I understand your argument about the victim's identification of your client. It seems like you're arguing two different things. One, that she may have had a bias to intentionally falsify her identification. But the other, it seems like you're saying that she might not have been able to accurately identify him at all. I'm trying to figure out which one you're arguing, or maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument.
I may have misspoke too. I it's the first. It's that she is purposefully misidentifying who shot her, that the long-term boyfriend is somebody that she who just as clearly could have shot her on this day, but she doesn't want to place the blame on him because of their relationship. And I can't remember if they have kids together, but I believe they do. And so that my client, based on their prior incidences, at least that she testified about, that she's placing the blame on him to place the blame on him because of her anger towards those prior incidences. Additionally, you know, we don't have the boyfriend who comes in and testifies about the prior incidences. We don't have anybody from the barbecue where the Spriegel incident, where she claims that my client pulled a gun on her. There is another woman at the scene, I know on the body cam, who makes a comment about how my client's done this before. That person doesn't come in and testify that they saw my client have an incident with her in the past. So again, this is a single person's testimony, you know, saying conclusively that my client did it, but there's no video camera from the apartment. There's nothing else to
corroborate
her
claims.
There isn't,
but isn't it the position, isn't it the role of the district court to determine the credibility of that testimony and weigh it, and not specifically not ours?
Well, I think it was brought up in the context of a mistrial motion. It wasn't brought up in the context at the end of the trial and evaluating the prejudice. It clearly the judge knew something went wrong here and didn't think it was as serious, but this court has its own independent ability to evaluate after viewing the entire trial transcript whether this was so prejudicial that it was deserving of a new trial. Unless the court has additional questions, I will cede my the rest of this time and potentially come up for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Alexandra Meyer on behalf of the state. As to the first issue, whether Mr. Harris Franklin's waiver of his right to counsel was valid, I would like to emphasize the specific facts and circumstances, as you were referring to, Judge Wheelock, that demonstrate appellant understood the rights he was waiving. He had counsel at the time he waived his right to counsel. That's an important factor. In case law, he had not one but two public defenders, and he didn't want either of them. He was represented for months by these attorneys, and his counsel worked on his behalf up to and including filing a written motion to proceed pro se on his behalf. Counsel reviewed the entire petition to proceed pro se, the judicial branch's provided form, line by line, before going on the record in court. And the attorney makes a record as an officer of the court. He says, I have gone through this line by line with my client. I intended to have him sign it on the record, but he's not going to do that now. The district court, having had experience with appellant's volatility on the record.
And what he'd be signing is that he understands.
He would be signing at the bottom of two pages of rights that had been explained to him that he understood.
Right. So without that signature and without having the court inquire of all the particulars, what would be the basis for us to conclude that he in fact understood those rights that he's waiving, or the consequence of waiving his rights?
So the district court definitely had went through, the district court went through a great deal of his rights, and knowing that he had just been told them by his counsel when they reviewed the form.
I'm talking about those rights the district court didn't cover with him. What would be the basis for us to read this record and reach the conclusion that it seems pretty clear that the defendant, in fact, understood those rights?
I would point you to the fact that he had just fired his federal public defender within a week or two of that record. And that was something that was told, that his defense counsel told the parties and the judge, that he had just gotten through firing his federal public defender that caused a delay in this case. He had a significant experience with the criminal justice system. He had, I believe, 8 prior convictions, 5 enough recent enough that they were used for impeachment. There's also a presumption in the case law that a defendant who is represented at the time he is waiving counsel understands what counsel can do for him. Additionally, the court appointed advisory counsel, and that is also a strong factor showing that counsel or that the defendant understands the role that counsel plays, and yet he never asked advisory to counsel to take over his representation. He never objected to advisory counsel once it was appointed. He used the services of advisory counsel.
You mentioned the experience that he has with the criminal justice system. Is there any information on the record that would inform us that he has experience representing himself in the criminal justice system?
Not to my knowledge, apart from the fact that he was representing himself in federal court on the gun and ammunition charge at the same time. You also see the defendant repeatedly referring to his Sixth Amendment rights, repeatedly trying to tell the court, I'm supposed to sign something and I didn't sign anything, which reads as if he's manipulating the system to some degree. He's aware that there is a procedure that he's supposed to go to. He refused to comply with the procedure. And then 2 other additional hearings, he points to it and says, see, I didn't actually sign anything. Therefore, and then he asks for, or he attempts to delay the proceedings.
Right, that explains why there's no written, signed recognition of understanding rights. But I don't know if that covers the other concern we have, that with the lack of a written signing, there's also a lack of district court covering all of the details.
So,
and securing the understanding that otherwise the court would be aware of had he signed, had the defendant actually signed the form.
So I would point you to the Rhodes decision, which sets forth the standard that you look to when a defendant did not execute a written waiver on the record. I believe it's Rhodes. I had it pulled up and then I lost it.
I think it stands for the proposition that particular facts and circumstances of the case can demonstrate a valid waiver.
Right. So we're not looking at a bright line rule where we say there has to be a specific statement on the record that he understands all of these things in order for the waiver of counsel to be valid. We're looking at the entire picture, and here that entire picture is quite complex, and it's not just about did he during that particular hearing with the judge express that he understood certain things. We're not going point by point. And I think it's very strong evidence that he understood what was going on, that his attorney reviewed the petition to proceed pro se with him in full and presumably had another conversation with him prior to that when the attorney filed on his behalf a motion to proceed pro se. So this is a very well-counseled gentleman. Now, whether he wants to agree with the legal advice he's getting is not as clear, but he certainly has been presented with the law, and I think the record reflects that his attorney had met with him on multiple occasions and explained what was going on.
I want to make sure you have enough time to address the the significant, your acknowledgement that there was plain error, and I'd like you to help us to understand why this video presentation was not prejudicial.
So I do agree there is plain error, and I would correct something that is in my brief. I think I referenced that the judge gave the defendant the ability to review the transcripts before the video was played. That when I went back and reviewed more fully preparing for this argument, I realized he said he didn't want to review the 911 transcript. There was no transcript prepared prior to trial for the body-worn camera footage. I think that's actually an important point because the jury never saw the word DOC. They didn't see on paper specific language. They heard one time and one time only this back and forth between officers in a hallway for 12 seconds during a 33-minute body-worn camera video. That's, you could describe that as in passing.
And he pointed a gun at her last week. So this week he finally shot her. I actually think that's more significant than the DOC reference. And correct me if you think otherwise.
I think that whole segment should not have been played, but the judge heard it when it was happening and she looked at the jury and she did not see anything that concerned her. We could be here on a denial of mistrial position.
What would the judge see? I mean, the judge can't read minds. Would the judge expect to hear a gasp?
No, the judge looking at the members of the jury is very familiar with how they react to evidence. She's watched this whole thing. She's watched the defendant get up and say, I didn't plan to represent myself. And she sees how the jury reacts. She corrects. She did not feel it was sufficient to grant a mistrial. We could be here on an abuse of discretion standard for denial of the mistrial.
Well, the court was concerned about something. Wasn't it the court that stopped the action and drew attention to the presentation?
Which is absolutely appropriate. That's what we want the court to do in these circumstances. The court did rather...
So I'm just suggesting that maybe the court was more concerned than you're suggesting the court was about what impact this had on the jury or could have had on the jury.
So the court was concerned. She then listened two or three times to the video because there was no transcript and she couldn't clearly understand what was said there. So that also bears on whether or not the jury understood enough for there to be potential prejudice. You can see on the record, she and advisory counsel go back and forth on what the actual word was. Did it say surprise? But I don't remember the exact word. She and advisory counsel go back and forth on what it was. They listen to it again. And then the judge offers, clarify the record. The judge offers offers a corrective instruction and the defendant immediately says, yes, I want that. And she says, hold on, let me explain what that means. And she explains that that could highlight the information for the jury. And at that point, the defendant says, no, I don't want that. So she is clearly aware, this judge made an incredibly good record, in my opinion. She's clearly aware of what's going on, what effect this could have. And I think, to your point, Judge Wheelock, she is in the best position to decide how prejudicial this was, and for us to look at it now without knowing how the jury was reacting seems like a potentially an overreach on the judge's understanding of what was going on.
Well, it's the state's burden at this point, isn't it, to demonstrate no prejudice?
Yes.
And so what would you say, besides your argument that it might not have been understood by the jury and the judge had this connection with the jury that allowed her to recognize there was no thoughts going on in their head and of a prejudicial nature, What else, if anything, could we rely upon to agree with you that you've met your burden to show that there, this was not prejudicial to the defendant?
So the two things. The defendant testified and he was impeached with five prior convictions. I think that would be, if anything, more important than this for how the jury viewed him. Secondly, I'm going to forget what second was. I always do that.
It's okay. You'll remember right when you're leaving and your clock has run out.
But would it be the victim's testimony that he's the guy?
The victim's testimony was, if you read the entirety of the victim's testimony with the state and then the defendant's cross-examination of the victim, their interaction is very odd. It's very unusual. They have this, they go back and forth and nothing the defendant says helps his situation in the slightest. And then when he testifies on his own behalf, he gets up and says, I've never been to this address ever in my entire life, despite dating a woman there, despite her testimony where she kind of waffles on whether he's ever been there. His testimony is so unbelievable. It's factually impossible, not just not credible. So the actual testimony in this trial, what the victim says and what the defendant says, makes this one of those cases where this 13-second blip had very, was so unlikely to affect the verdict that it does not impact his substantial rights.
During cross-examination of the victim, did the appellant attempt to impeach the victim with the whole boyfriend issue, you're covering for your boyfriend?
Yes.
He did. Okay.
Yes, he went so far as to be like, didn't you have an order for protection at the time? Well, then why was he at your house? And they go back and forth for several times. And she admits that her boyfriend had flashed a gun at her, that there was a mention of a gun. And this is, I think, somewhere in the body-worn camera as well. There's some stuff about her boyfriend.
Counsel, there's just a little under 2 minutes remaining on your time. I think it would be helpful if you maybe address the fourth prong here.
So this case is like many of these pro se defendant cases, a tough job for the courts because we assume that attorneys do a lot of work to keep the court running and to make things flow. And here you have a defendant who is not interested in helping the procedures along, rightly so. This is, you know, he's on trial. But that also means that this is not a case where looking at the conviction you need to reverse because it would affect the understanding of how the judicial process works. This is not a case where anyone was trying, where the judge was doing her best to recognize and protect this defendant's rights. The prosecutor was at most negligent in not redacting this. And I would point out, this video went back with the jury. This was one of the first cases where the laptop and all the discovery went back to the deliberation room. And there's a record, there's a bit in the transcript about that. So that's important because the jury presumably watched this video again and they never heard this reference again. So before reaching their verdict, they would have had access to this video again that was redacted and they would not hear this information again.
What is there in the record that would help us to agree with your perspective that it was at most negligent by the prosecutor?
I see my time is up. Can I briefly respond?
Certainly.
I believe you looked at the judge's finding. The judge, she never berates the prosecutor. I think she understands you're in a situation where normally a defense attorney would have reviewed the video and would bring these things to light. And she said, if there was an objection, I would have ruled that way. But there was no defense attorney. This is a 33-minute video with no transcript. And the only person theoretically right before trial that's listened to it is the officer to affirm that it's his recording. So I think if the judge had believed, she made a very thorough record. So if she believed that the attorney had been doing this deliberately, she for sure would have said so and it would have affected her decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Quickly, Your Honors. So I was able to find something at least.
Just for the record, if you could state your name for the
video. Yeah, sorry. DeVee Axelson.
Thank you.
reappearing for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Yep. So I was looking through respondent's brief on page 11 of their brief and referring to page 327 of the transcript. The state said that Judge Olmstead thought about whether to give the instruction overnight after there was some discussion, and that she decided she didn't want to give the instruction. My client didn't specifically request it either at that point, but it was the judge's decision whether that makes any difference here. But,
thanks for the clarification.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that. Referring to a little bit of the discussion about the fact that the defense attorney said that he read the plea petition or the waiver of counsel petition with my client. Again, we don't know if my client was listening. We know they had a strained relationship. And again, we don't know that he understood it because he didn't acknowledge it. I think that the reliance of the state on my client's prior convictions coming in sanitized felonies is not the same thing as police officers standing around in a hallway and commiserating about how guilty my client is and how he for sure did this prior thing and laughing about it and saying how he's going back to the DOC, which really is a reference to going back to incarceration. I think this court can listen to that video and decide for themselves if they thought that it's loud enough where you can hear. I had no issues listening to it. I agree that it wasn't ultimately given to the jury, but without any instruction either, we don't know where the jury was left with that statement. Finally, I think Ramey and all the other prosecutorial misconduct cases specifically say that the prosecutor plays a role in granting a defendant a fair trial too. So here the prosecutor does not get a pass because there wasn't a defense attorney on the other side. If anything, they should probably be extra careful when it's pro se to make sure that information that clearly should not be introduced is coming in. Unless the court has additional questions, we ask for the relief discussed in my brief.
I think what I'm looking back at your brief, and I am seeing that you paused, you stopped, I think, after discussing whether substantial. You basically said the state cannot show that the error did not affect your client's substantial rights.
Yep.
You don't really discuss the fourth prong. Do you want to address that now?
Yeah, I apologize. And I think we discussed this last month in the other case that I was before, at least two of the judges before, that typically when the defendant is successful on the three prongs of plain error when it comes to prosecutorial misconduct, I've never seen this court or the Supreme Court uphold the conviction based on the fourth prong. So I think particularly here, the fairness of the justice system has a reliance on the prosecutor's role in making sure a defendant has a fair trial. And so there, I can't think of a situation, especially not this one, where something so obviously inadmissible gets introduced by the prosecutor where this court should find that didn't affect the integrity and fairness of the system.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I did have one question, Mr. Erickson.
Yeah.
So, and obviously we'll check this whole thing about the status of the instruction. Do you agree that at one point the judge asked your client for the instruction and then he first said yes, and then she explained, well, you know, it could highlight it, and then he said no. I mean, did he ultimately decide he did not want the instruction given?
I don't specifically remember. I don't have any reason to doubt that the prosecutor provided an accurate summation on that
check
point. Thank you.
I will say, and I don't mean this as a comment about any of the prosecutors, but we are beginning to see more and more of these, nobody looked at the videotape, and we wouldn't be here if the prosecutor, and I'm not suggesting anyone's doing anything incorrect, you're all busy, but you know, someone looked at the videotape, we wouldn't be on half of this appeal. And I just think perhaps Ms. Meyer, you need to sort of remind your colleagues that it's harder for you on appeal if they didn't review the videotape, because that's, you know, that is problematic. So that's all I have to say. Thank you, Judge.
And I think that, you know, some education to the district court public defenders on making
well,
sure that they're objecting
this,
to it, too.
I suppose we could reverse this.
I certainly can provide education to pro se clients on that. But thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. And thank you for your briefing and for your oral argument today. Nicely done by both of you. We appreciate your representation. I'm sure your clients do as well. Matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.